Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi there, Tip Off listeners. Hope you're well. I've got something a bit different for you in this episode. I'm busy lining things up for Series 4, but in the meantime, I've dipped my toe into the perilous waters of the live podcast world. In early September, I hosted an event for Audible's Spoken Worlds Festival, where I got to speak to the journalists behind the fantastic podcast series West Cork. Now, it was all something of an experiment, but I really enjoyed hearing how Sam Bungie and Jennifer Ford had managed to make sense of decades worth of rumours and whispers to produce a sensitive exploration of what happens when a murder investigation goes wrong. So here's a bit of my conversation with Sam and Jennifer. It was in the big echoey hall at Lincoln's Inn Fields, and we went over all the twists and turns that happened to get their story out. Hope you enjoy.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. If you can please put your hands together for Maeve, Jennifer and Sam.
Hello.
Hi, Sam.
Sorry. Take a seat, guys. So, welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us in this very spectacular building. We couldn't be much further, I think, from the wind-blown cliffs of West Cork, but here we are. Okay. With us today, we've got Sam Bungie and Jennifer Ford, who are going to be talking to us about their incredible work. My name's Maeve McLennigan. I'm an investigative journalist, and I'm the host of a podcast called The Tip Off, where we look into the stories behind some amazing investigations. And so we're going to start today with that very moment of the tip-off of where this story came from. So, take you all back. It's late 2014, and Sam and Jennifer are sat in a London flat, and they picked up a copy of The Observer. And there's an article there with a headline that reads, "Britain accused of filmmaker's murder puts Irish police in the dock." And reading on, they couldn't quite believe what it was they were reading. This story focused on one man, a journalist called Ian Bailey. And he's a prime suspect in a brutal murder. But Ian had never been charged. And now he's trying to sue the Irish police for harassment and wrongful arrest. So it sounds like a fascinating story, an unsolved murder case where the police seemed like they just couldn't manage to get their man. So it's enough to whet their appetites. And Sam and Jennifer board a flight and you fly to Dublin, right? You want to be there when Ian's case comes to trial. So maybe, Jennifer, can you tell us what's going through your head that first day as you walk in the courtroom?
So it was, I think what struck us most initially was just how much attention there was on it. It was like a packed courthouse. We got there what we thought was early and all of the seats in the viewing gallery were taken. There were loads of journalists outside taking photographs. And again, we just kind of assumed that there were always, you know, photographers outside a courthouse taking photographs, but they were all there for him. There's this kind of throng of men in suits around outside the front of the, inside, but outside the actual courtroom. So I think that's what initially kind of struck us. And then Ian is so tall, he kind of stands a foot above everybody else. And weirdly, his legal team are all tiny. So he's sort of there looming over them.
And at this stage, so obviously there's a trial going on. Could you get close to Ian? Like, was this, were you thinking, you know, if we could just grab him in the corridor, we could start to have these conversations? What was your kind of game plan for how to get to him?
A little, that is what we thought, uh-huh. actually, and then realised that it sort of wasn't going to happen. But what happened? You gave him a note or something?
It was a case where if you spent enough time there, if you hung out at the forecourts in Dublin, mm-hmm. there's this sort of daily coming, you know, everyone's routines have become quite obvious quite quickly, and I did go up to him quite soon after we got there and tried to talk to him, but he at first just kind of put his hand to his lips and said, I can't talk to you. No, not nothing, in fact. I think he just walked away. Mm. And then we went up to him again, the two of us, outside of the courtroom, and spoke to him and Jules after a day.
Yeah, briefly, and said what we were interested in doing. And he said, oh, I haven't said that Sam had worked for This American Life in America. Mm-hmm. And he said, oh, I haven't. My story's been in England and Ireland, but it hasn't been in America yet. So obviously something, mm-hmm. you know, appealed to him about sharing his story more widely for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
So at this stage, you have the inkling that this is a really interesting story, something you want to dig into. But you guys are based in London, right? So presumably, you know, you realise quite early on you have to go and see this landscape, this area, this small town called Skull in West Cork, where this all happened. Can you remember your very first impressions of turning up in Skull? Maybe, Sam, you could tell us a little bit about, you know, the landscape, what that's like there.
Skull is sort of the unofficial capital of this part of West Cork. So there's these, like, three jagged peninsulas at the... north is Kerry, and this part of West Cork is sort of all jutting out in the Atlantic. And Skull is like a seaside community, like a fishing town officially, but it's kind of seasonal, and there's a big influx of tourists in the summer, and it's very bustling, and you know, there's a food market and so on. But then in the winter, it's quite a different place, you know, so like many seasonal places. And it's still, you know, lively in the daytime, but at night, which is when we first arrived there, it's, you know, like crickets, yeah. Mm-hmm. And you come in and the police station's there, lights off, and as you go west, it becomes quieter and quieter. And between the little villages, there's very little at all, you know, and it can be mountainous because there's a mountain there, and then you get to the coast very quickly, and it's really beautiful, obviously, mm-hmm. But quite rugged. Mm.
And so the reason all of this was happening, the reason you were out there, is because way out in that rugged countryside, back in 1996, a woman had been murdered. A woman called Sophie Toscan de Plantier, who was French, but she often frequented a holiday home in Skull or just outside it. And Sophie was found one morning outside her holiday home in her nightdress, but with her boots laced up on her feet, and her head and face had been bludgeoned. And beside her body on the ground was a bloodied rock and a piece of slate. Now, this was a horrifically violent murder, and I think it's really important to remember that, you know, around all of this compelling storytelling, there's a real woman with a real family at the heart of all of this who suffered a really horrible crime. Jennifer, maybe you can tell us a bit about, you know, these kind of true crime stories can be complicated, right? Not just factually, but ethically as well. And this, you know, involves a death of an innocent woman. So what kind of things were you considering when you were kind of first thinking about whether this was something to dig into?
All sorts of questions about those particular issues. I mean, I think first we felt that we probably wouldn't have done it if Sophie's family weren't on board with it, or if they didn't want us to do it, because it didn't really feel like we had the right to go poking around in this story without their permission. But they have a really sort of organized group of people around them in Paris that are all kind of fighting to keep the case alive and to keep sort of momentum moving towards justice, whatever that looks like. I mean, to them, it looks like Ian Bailey behind bars. But either way, just towards some resolution. So I think as soon as we knew that this was very much a live story, you know, it hasn't gone away. It's not a case of kind of, you know, digging things up where people would much rather you just didn't talk about them. In fact, everybody was very ready to talk, and they really wanted to talk just in the right way. So so that was important for us, to get them, you know, just involved. And we went to Paris and met them, and, you know, they were very considered, and they sort of wanted to, had all sorts of questions, but ultimately were, you know, were into it. So, and then in terms of actually telling the story, I think it's a really, I'm sure it happens with all sorts of murders, but we do have, you know, kind of a lot of stories about murdered women, you know, fiction, non-fiction. So how to tell it in the right way, so how to kind of strike a balance between it being, having enough information where the listener feels like they're getting those bits that that they can start coming up with theories themselves, but then also being respectful to the victim and kind of being mindful of not sort of fetishizing the female victim. And I think that it was that our balance, we thought that, you know, people should know as much about Sophie and how Sophie died as who she was when she was alive, and, you know, trying to kind of have her as a person in there, even kind of before. That was kind of partly the reason why we structured it the way we structured it, that you know Sophie, who she is, before you know Ian as a suspect, because once he's in the picture, it's really hard for him not to sort of dominate it.
But at this stage, there's lots of ways you could tell this story, right? It could be a kind of documentary, it could be a documentary film, it could be another series of articles. So at this stage, were you quite clear that it was going to be a podcast and it was going to be a podcast series? When did that kind of crystallize in your minds as that was going to be the medium?
I think always we wanted to do it as a podcast. Yeah, that, because, you know, it felt halfway between what we do, you know, Sam's a journalist and I'm a documentary producer, so it felt like it was a middle ground. But also, I think we were excited about the way that podcasting allows you to tell a story, you know, that you can go off on tangents and you can go into detail, and you can also just be much more low-key than a whole, having a film crew with you. I mean, we couldn't have, I don't think you could have made this as a documentary. I mean, I think maybe
the cost as well. I mean,
the cost of it, yeah, and just the imposition of it, you know, the kind of going into people's homes and scheduling a crew, and even if we'd just been filming ourselves, it's just much more, you know, it's less intense, you know, just a little microphone on the table. It's much more discreet, and I think probably helped us a great deal to get access. So I think we knew that that would be a strength in terms of getting access. And
but so you have this sense at this point that there's all these kind of different narratives, there's all these different viewpoints. Where, you know, if for the rest of us that haven't done this investigation, where on earth do you start with that? You've kind of got Sophie's family on board, you've got Ian signifying that he's going to be up for talking, but presumably you know you need to talk to dozens more people. You know, do you sit down and make a kind of wish list? What is your plan? Do you get out the phone directory for Skull and literally work your way through? How is it that you kind of scope out who it is you're going to talk to?
Yeah, we
all of that.
All of that.
Easy.
Yeah, exactly. All of that.
But also, actually, we should, like, we definitely didn't have ambitions on that scale at the beginning. I guess we sort of obviously hoped that we would be able to speak to everyone, but we were given, I don't know how much we gave ourselves the impression, but we were also sort of told that by various people that, you know, it was going to be a difficult thing to get people to talk about, which sort of makes common sense. But we thought that, I think initially we thought if we had the access to the suspect in Ian Bailey and to Sophie's family, that even that felt like initially enough, because there was this 20 years of case history.
Yeah. And I think then really what, I mean, in terms of figuring out how big it was going to be and what shape it would take, then Audible, we heard, were looking for 13 parts, for stories that could be 13 parts. And so then you kind of have to think about it differently, because I think initially we were thinking like maybe three episodes and it would be three different people and three different perspectives of the case or something like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, and, you know, we had all sorts of ideas of like how, what kind of a podcast it could be. But suddenly when it has to be 13 episodes, then you think, well, it just evolved into telling the story chronologically and getting as many people involved as we could. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, one of the extraordinary things I think that anyone that's listened to the podcast will agree with is this incredible access to Ian, who's the man at the centre of this whole story. So for those of you that don't know, so Ian Bailey was a journalist in England before he packed that all in and moved to West Cork. And there he was working as a freelance journalist, writing the odd piece here and there about town fairs or other village events. But it was quiet stuff. It was hardly the kind of thing that was going to make his name and bring him fame and fortune as a journalist. So when Sophie was murdered, Ian was all over the story. And it was, you know, it was after all the biggest news event, I guess, that had happened in Skull for a long time. But pretty soon after the murder, Ian was on the police's radar because some of the stories he was filing seemed to have details that an outsider really shouldn't know. And his alibi for the night was that he'd been at home with his wife, Jules. But she was asleep for most of the night, and the police reasoned it wasn't impossible that he could have walked or driven over to Sophie's and got back in time. And then there were these unusual scratches and a wound on his head that no one had noticed the day before. And Ian said these came from cutting down a tree and killing a turkey for Christmas, but the police seemed highly suspicious. So maybe we can listen to a clip from the show. And this is the moment when, after the murders happened, and Ian is realizing that the police are starting to look at him strangely.
Ian spent Christmas in a frenzy at the typewriter. He wrote half a dozen stories about the murder over those first few days. The day after Christmas, he came up for air and left the cottage.
I'd gone into town early in the morning to get some messages, some briquettes and milk, and then I noticed I was being observed then by two officers. I knew one of them was a member of Ngata Shekana. I didn't know the other. I guessed he was.
The two officers both filed statements about this incident. They were in the newsagents, a small corner shop in Skull, when Ian walked in. He drew attention to himself by barging his way to the counter. One of them wrote in a statement that Ian was unbelievably pale. He was unshaven and his hair was in disarray. To me, he was acting in a very unusual manner. Ian was wearing long sleeves, so the guards could only see as far as his wrists. But both guards were struck by what they saw on his hands.
Well, I mean, just to scratches on the back of my hands, I did have light markings. They weren't blood scratches. They were... they're hard to describe.
The guards followed Ian out of the shop. In their statements, they described this curious scene, watching Ian look back over his shoulder at them as he walked away, and then turn off the main street, only to poke his head back around the corner moments later, as if to check they were still watching.
So who is this man? Is he a cold-blooded killer or is he simply a strange outsider that's been scapegoated for a violent crime? So you guys had talked to Ian, obviously, in court, and he kind of had sounded like he was interested in this. But maybe you could talk us through, you know, really getting him on board, because it's going to take a lot of commitment, I guess, from him in this project to keep going. How was it that you presented the idea to him?
We wrote him a letter, right, from London.
That's right, yeah. So we wrote him a letter. So after speaking to him at court, and he was basically said, interesting, that I've never had any kind of coverage of my case in the US or in the UK. But can't speak to you because this case is happening, if I would speak to you at all. But then the case kind of wore on for months, and we sent him a letter back in London, just sort of pleading our case, and got a call from him, like sort of within 2 days, sort of the magic of the old-fashioned mail. He got it and called us back straight away and said, yeah, there's a, you know, the evidence has been heard, so there's a break in the case at the moment, come out and meet me. And so we got there late one evening in the middle of the week, and we wanted to kind of go out and meet him the following morning, I think, at his house, because we were aware that Skull was a small town, but he wanted to meet us that evening at a pub right in the middle of town called The Black Sheep. And so we met him there, and he was quite standoffish at the start and was sort of saying, I don't know how I can help you, and I'm not sure what your plan is.
But there was a kind of, you know, the empty pub, and you're speaking to the man behind the bar about him, right? And
then that's
suddenly
right, yeah.
He walked in, and he's kind of wearing this, like, massive... I mean, it's like a scene in the film. It's this, like, quiet bar, and he walked in this massive, like... head-to-toe raincoat with a big deerstalker hat, and then said, what to the man, have you got any of that pie left?
I mean, pudding, the whole
thing, yeah. Is there any pudding left in the kitchen? And
but it was a really awkward scene, actually, because we were speaking to the only person in the bar, which was the barman, mm-hmm. about, he said, are you waiting for someone? Because there was sort of no other reason to be there, and I was just about to say his name, as he walked in, yeah. And sort of in the shock of the moment, I kind of blurted out, speak of the devil, which was not...
Good start.
Yeah.
And then he just conjured him up.
Filled it, yeah, and then he was like, have you got any more of that delicious pudding? A sort of strange shift seemed to happen, as I remember in the conversation, we were going from us speaking to the suspect in the case to him sort of taking on a role that he used to take on professionally, which is sort of as like a fixer or something. You know, so then he was suggesting how we might spend our few days there and quickly suggested that he should take us out to the scene of the crime to show us where it is.
Now you can see it's pretty isolated.
Yeah, very
now my thinking always was you would never stumble across this place in a month of Sundays. It seems pretty clear to me that the only way you would finish up, or could finish up here, is if you knew the terrain and you knew the place.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/acast. That's 15% off at burrow.com/acast.
He seems to revel in publicity, right? Did you guys get a sense of what his motivations were for doing this? Somebody who's just kind of sued the police for this and seems to have a quite love-hate relationship with the way the press have covered his story in the past. Why did he agree to do it with you guys?
You just don't know what's... He's so hard to know what is going on in his head. Because I think on that trip or in another trip, certainly early on, we're kind of walking down the high street in Skull and it's absolutely lashing rain. And again, he has this enormous coat on. But he's carrying a massive book of, like, you know, anthology of serial killers. And he'd picked it up from the charity shop. But it's like, Ian, like... get a bag or put it under your coat. Just like, you just wonder, like, is he rubbing it in people's faces? Because the idea that he can't not make a connection between like the way everybody sees him and then walking down the road with like a book about serial killers. It's just, you know, you wonder, but who knows? Like on the one hand, it's totally fair enough that he should want to have, you know, get his side of the story out there. But on the other hand, it's hard not to wonder, is he kind of playing with you and playing with the people around him?
And he'd been keeping his own kind of meticulous records throughout the years, right? He'd been taping himself, you know, talking to himself, going over the records of the case. You know, maybe you guys could explain a little bit what his argument was for, you know, his innocence, why things had you know, what had gone wrong in the case that, in his mind that had led him to be unfairly represented.
Well, there's no case against him, really. I mean, it's all just stuff that kind of looks bad, and if you add it all up together, people think it looks very bad. But really, there's nothing concrete. But it's kind of, it's all that sort of circumstantial, suspicious stuff, and then him, you know, the way he behaved before the murder, the way he behaved after the murder, in the face of the accusation, the way he behaved towards his wife or to his partner Jules. Like, there's just, people didn't like him, and he was just a really good fit for this.
There's not a scintilla of forensic evidence against Ian, and he's provided blood samples. He's, you know, they've taken clothes, they've taken fingerprints and hair samples, and, you know, this was a bloody murder. There would be some trace of him. There isn't.
But there was one element, right, that did kind of swing things against Ian for a while, and that was the testimony of Marie Farrell. Mm. So Marie was a key witness in the police's case. She'd been out on the night of the murder. She'd been driving in a car with a former lover, and she was married. So it took her a while to kind of come forward and to kind of really tell what had happened. But eventually she said that on this drive, while she was out there, she saw this man walking along the country road somewhere near where Sophie lived. And when the guard had finally got to her, she presented a statement. And what she said finally was pretty damning for Ian.
Those of you who followed the case closely will remember that Marie Farrell was the shopkeeper whose testimony was a key factor in the outcome of the case. And Marie Farrell joins me now on the line. Marie, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
You actually saw Ian Bailey a mile from Sophie's home the night she was murdered.
I did, yes.
And what exactly did you see?
I was driving home after being out for the evening, and I just picked up this man in the headlights of my car, staggering along the road. Mm-hmm. He just appeared to be drunk. He was staggering and sort of waving his hands around.
Everybody knows now what you saw.
Yes,
because sworn in court as to what you saw.
Marie's first statement described a man who, frankly, didn't sound much like Ian at all. Medium height, slim and tanned. But as her statements progressed, like in a flipbook animation, the man in the black coat morphed into someone who looked just like the guard's prime suspect. Tall, powerfully built, pale and unshaven.
So you know Marie Farrell, she's this key piece of the puzzle. She's either the sole witness to this suspect out on the hills that night, or she's someone who's thrown the whole case off balance. So how do you go about finding her, and how do you get her to talk to you?
So we kind of danced around for ages because we didn't know where she was. We knew she wasn't in Skull anymore. And we asked Ian's lawyer if he would put us in touch with her. And he said yes, he would get in touch and ask if she was happy to talk. And then sort of months went by and we had no idea whether he had actually called her or sent her. He told us he did, but you kind of take his word for it. And then... But there was certainly no word back on, you know, he said he hadn't heard. And so then eventually just found her, you found her on social media, someone who, I mean, looked like a cat on social media, but
on Facebook,
had the right
on
name on Facebook. Uh-huh. And so, and messaged. And again, it's one of those messages you just kind of fire off. And a couple of months later, got a message back. And she, it was like a really kind of, hi, Sam, I'm away at the moment. Here's my number. I'll talk to you next week or something like that. Really straightforward.
Yeah.
You find her and you do the interview and she tells you some quite extraordinary things. We'll just play a short clip of that.
Well, I know it wasn't Ian Bailey I saw on the road, but I don't know who killed Sophie.
Over 3 days, we sat with Marie in her front living room, trying to understand how someone gets themselves into this kind of a pickle.
If I'd never made that phone call on Christmas Day, life would be different. If only I didn't go to court that day, if only I didn't go out that night, if only I didn't ring the guards. Life would be different, so different.
Must be quite extraordinary to be sat in the living room with her and her telling you these incredible things. This took years of reporting, right? And at the end of it, you must have had weeks, if not months, worth of tape and stories and hundreds of different characters. How did you keep that all organised, and where do you start when you come to write up the script for that?
Well,
endless whiteboards and post-it notes and...
Yeah, we sort of travelled with these two, whiteboards that you could erase, stick in the car or whatever, and we did. We used Trint, this sort of automated transcription thing, because, like you say, we had sort of dozens of hours just with Ian and
hundreds of like little pieces of white paper that you'd then find under the sofa and be like, what? You know, you'd think you'd done that episode and you'd see this like nugget that you now have to kind of jam in somewhere because actually it's really important.
Totally,
and you'd
yeah.
lost the piece, you know, it somehow got blown off the whiteboard or whatever.
And then while we were in West Cork, which we spent a lot of time there, we would kind of have to hop around places to stay. And so we'd be like carting these things around, and that's when we had everything pinned up. And also, whenever we left the house, we were really, conscious, paranoid, I guess, about making sure that all our workings were like not visible in case.
Set up an investigating room and then kind of take it all down again.
Break it down.
And close the curtains so that people who we imagine peering in the window and trying to like see what we were up to wouldn't see these big whiteboards with all like their names on them. I mean, it was way over the
top. Yeah, it's a small place. But, like, that was, I think a lot of that
it's
was
really easy
mind.
To, yeah, scare yourself.
Yeah, it's like the wire on the move constantly.
Yeah.
and not even just people, you know, the locals and neighbours peering in the windows, but, you know, myself, having done long-term investigative projects, there's always this kind of fear in the back of your mind that, you know, what if you got scooped at any minute? What if somebody, somebody else breaks this story or there's a big change in the case that means you can't report it? Was that something that was you were nervous about, or was there a moment when you realised you're so out ahead of the rest of the game that it's yours now?
Well, I don't think it was a case of like worrying about being ahead of the game, because it was something that like it was, you know, it was in the papers basically every day, more, you know, certainly for big chunks of time that we were doing it in Ireland, because it's just a case that like drips along, and so people are like it, and journalists who followed it from the beginning are still doing that, and we're doing it at the time. But it was more like we got to a stage, I think, in the process of researching it and interviewing people, that it felt like to do what we were doing, we're trying to do, takes that amount of time, and so like we would be finished before anyone else then started. So. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. We didn't spend that much time thinking about that, I think.
Yeah.
And so you have this mad scramble of kind of pulling this together from something that you were wondering how you were possibly going to stretch it into a 3-episode series to suddenly having too much, I guess, to fit even 13 episodes. Mm. And it finally gets released in February. What's the reaction been like, you know, particularly, I guess, from Ian and from Sophie's family?
Good, yeah. I mean, we were really worried about that, obviously. We sent Sophie's family an earlier copy of it, even though we were making changes up to like 3 days before it went out. Mm-hmm. But we sent Sophie's family just in case, you know, there was anything that they were upset by or, you know, whatever. But they were happy with it. And then Ian, we didn't hear from, right, for... We had to get him a, because he, you know, doesn't have the internet at home and isn't a member of Amazon or Audible, but we felt like we needed to get him a copy, because it would be unfair for people to have listened to it and he didn't.
And getting calls. And, yeah.
So my cousin lives in one town over, and we got him to put it on CDs, but then he said he'd drop it up to him. We were like, what if he hates it? Is he going to go after my cousin? So we needed to try and figure out a way. So we told him we're going to leave it at the post office. It'll be under your name. So Brian went. I mean, it was just, again, so stealth. But
that was the day of the release.
That was the day of the release. On the day of the release, there was an envelope marked Ian Bailey at the post office, which he went down and collected. And then we didn't hear from him. And then about a month later, we got a phone call and like a few missed calls and ran through all before calling him back. We did loads of rehearsed answers, like, okay, if he says this, this is what we say. If he hates this bit, if he hates, like, all of the things we imagined he would hate, ran through what our answers would be. And then Sam rang him back, and episode 2 was blaring in the background in his kitchen, and it was his on second round, and he liked it, I think.
He was doing impressions of some of the characters in the thing. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know. I think since he's, like, calibrated, I think now he's kind of listened to the bits that he's kind of... Different bits probably loom out at him than they did initially. I think initially he was kind of into how balanced it was and how much he was in it and all of that stuff. But he said that he picked out a couple of lines being unnecessary, the bits from his old life in the UK. He kind of picked out some of those details as he thought they were a bit unnecessary. Like the bit about him crying on the bed and whatever, but, you know, fair enough. But it's interesting because we've been back and he's changed. And it's like he heard the podcast and really kind of studied how he's portrayed in it and is now making a conscious decision not to be that man. So he goes out to bars all the time and just kind of doesn't acknowledge. So when we were trying to talk to him again and say, what about that, you know, because you don't, what are you talking about? What people think I did this? Nobody thinks I did it. And you're just like, oh my God. It's just like you couldn't. It would be really hard to do it now. He's completely changed. And I don't know if you remember the whole thing about the moon stick, the stick that we go in for ages. And we went round and round it with him because loads of people, obviously, and we've, you know, put tape of them in the series of them talking and describing the stick, and then he absolutely is kind of so flippant about it and like, what stick? I don't understand. Is it a, what is a moon stick? And makes a kind of joke about it. And then when we were there, we were with a photographer who said, maybe we could get you out in the landscape, like walking somewhere, like if you've got you know, and he kind of misremembered it and just said, what about that's the stick? And he went, yeah, I'll just go and get it. And went into his shed and brought out a massive staff.
A moon stick.
And Sam and I were standing there going, is he for real? Like, is that the moon stick, Ian? And he just, like, absolutely, like, I don't know, just constantly shifting things. And you don't know why he's doing it. So, yeah.
So now he might put his book about serial killers inside a bag when he walks down the road. Maybe he's learned
this. Yeah, but exactly. Resurrect the moon stick. I mean, who
knows? Bring that back.
Yeah, it's very strange.
Well, I mean, it's an absolutely fantastic series. I think everyone can agree. It's sensitively explored, it's incredibly deeply researched, and it's a really fascinating story.
That's all for this episode of The Tip Off. Thanks to Sam Bungie and Jennifer Ford for talking to me. You can listen to West Cork on Audible. I'd really recommend it. Our theme music is by Dice Muse, and clips from West Cork are used thanks to Audible. Do stay tuned to the tip-off for more stories behind the headlines. And if you have a second, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, or tweet us at Tip-Off Podcast. Thanks, see you soon.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.